Good morning. January 26th, it's 10:18. This is the second meeting of the second session of the House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade and Tourism. Present this morning, Representative Gardner, Representative Thompson, Representative Tuck, Representative Keller, and myself, Bob Herron. And we do have the Resources Co-Chair, Paul Seaton, and in the back row, out of camera side, is Representative Bryce Edgman, which if Reggie doesn't show up, I'm going to ask him to join us here as well. Today on the agenda is House Concurrent Resolution 19, Oil and Gas Policy, Norway Policy Tour, and it is acknowledging the lessons learned from the 2011 Norway Policy Tour. Of course, everyone knows at the encouragement and encouraging investment in oil and gas industry. Of course, Institute North was started this, and it was a pleasure to be a part of that trip. So the legislation is something that we're going to take testimony on, but we're not going to we can discuss it, but we're not going to take action on this resolution until next week. And then I'm ask my committee members if there are suggestions that they might have, ideas that probably should be included in the resolution, and of course if there should be some deletions. We do have a full agenda. I expect that we will take the full hour and a half, and that is a segue to the House Resources Lunch and Learn on the Norway Policy Tour. Just for information, at 11:15 a.m., that's 9:15 p.m. in Norway, we will have Lund Semmingsen and Beheta Benson of the Norwegian Ministry of Finance Tax Policy Department, and they will be available to answer any questions. Also, the Director of Division of Oil and Gas, Bill Barron, is in the room and will also be available for a question. But our presenters today, of course, will be the Institute of the North, Niels Andreessen, Executive Director, Ira Perman, the Chairman, and Bradford Keithley of Perkins Coie, Environmental Energy Resources and Oil and Gas side of that law firm. And they will give us a PowerPoint on the Norway Policy Tour, and Mr. Keithley will focus in on state direct financial interest provision that Norway uses. Also, Representative Paul Seaton and Representative Bryce Esmin, who are on the Norway Policy Tour, will have make some comments as well. Next week, we will have a video from Anders Lindseth, the Director General of the Norwegian Ministry of Petroleum and Energy, and he will give a presentation as well next week. And last but not least, Mark Myers, the Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, will testify or share comments on what from Norway might work in Alaska. So we do have a full agenda, and so at this time, Niels, Ira, Bradford, could you come forth at in the sequence that that you wish, and please state your name for the record and your affiliation, and begin your presentation this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Niels Andreessen. I'm the Managing Director of the Institute of the North. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Institute of the North and a contingent of 45 Alaskans from the public, private, academic, and nonprofit sectors returned from a week-long policy tour of Norway in September. We're pleased with the level of attention the trip has received both from the media and public, and view it as our responsibility to share some of the useful things we learned about Norway's oil and gas development, economy, tax structure, and development climate. Given the ongoing discussion around Alaska's competitiveness, the ideas and information we gained were invaluable. The Institute's Norway policy tour was spurred by our commitment to seeking out and bringing back to Alaska new ideas, best practices, and strengthened partnerships, understanding northern issues, addressing common challenges, and taking advantage of unique opportunities has a lot to do with building relationships. The importance of relationships was a theme we encountered in Norway, whether we were talking about Norway's role in Arctic governance or government's relationship with the private sector. Norway's leaders prioritized strong communication and collaboration. Moreover, we heard how those relationships factored into three core values of competitiveness, capacity building, and competency. The Institute of the North is in no way advocating for a singular policy prescription. There are many differences between Alaska and Norway. We recognize this. This trip offered an opportunity to examine how we can improve our system to effectively manage development, encourage investment, and ensure Alaskans get their fair share from state-owned resources. We can study what others have done, not to replicate their systems, but to improve our own. In today's global economy, it's not enough to say that we don't give a darn how they do it outside. That is not the world we live in. Adapting the lessons learned from others and sharing our experiences while building relationships along the way is an integral part of leadership. I appreciate this committee's interest in what Norway has to offer, and I consider this a great opportunity for Alaska leadership that integrates new ideas and best practices while strengthening strategic partnerships. Ira Perman will go into more detail about what we've learned on our Norway policy tour. Thank you.
Okay, a little housekeeping. We've had other members of the committee join us. Representative Foster, Representative Tuck, Representative Olson, for the record. Please, sir. Ira.
Chairman Herron, my name is Ira Perman. I am the chair of the board of directors of the Institute of the North, and thank you and thank members of the committee for inviting us to make this presentation. The hardest thing for us to do is to try and hone down what we learned in an amazing week of educational seminars with the various ministers into a 20-minute presentation. Very difficult to do. We'll try. This slide that you have in front of you is what the Institute of the North calls our neighborhood. If you come over to our office, you'll see maps like this. This is the perspective we have of the globe. We look at the Arctic. In fact, in Norway, we saw a lot of maps just like this as well. This is how they look at the world from the top down. Why did we go? I think everybody has seen this slide. And Representative Foster, good to see you again, too. And Representative Seaton, great to have you in front of us. And it's a joy to have you both with us on the tour, as well as Representative Edgman in the back. This is why we went. We're very concerned about our production, oil production. It's in decline. And then the red there says the main thing, our economic future is uncertain. And we've been hearing over the years that Norway was coming on with some pretty good ideas in a whole lot of areas. We decided to focus in on this aspect of their oil and gas production. We could have looked at many things, and we will in the future, but this was the worry we had, and you're all familiar with this. The 45 of us who went over that, it each meant a different thing. To me, it meant, what are my kids going to get to do when they grow up? Are they going to have a career here? Are they going to be able to raise a family here? Will they be able to have good schools here? I'd like the answer to be yes, so hence I went over there. This is a chart I'm sure you're all familiar with. You look at this and wonder what's that all going to mean. At the moment, we have high oil prices, and they're keeping the ship of state financially afloat. But this particular projection came right out of the administration, and what it shows is that for a period of time, while the flow is high enough, we're going to have surpluses, but in not too many years, it's 7 on this chart, we'll start into that red area, which is where we don't want to go, and we want to find ourselves a way out of that, and we need to do that with some speed and haste, but with careful deliberation. So we went there with this in mind. Quick little overview on Norway. This is a map. The Atlantic is off to the left. Sweden would be the border on the right. We've superimposed where a couple of major cities in Alaska, our anchors being slightly above the main city of Oslo, where we came back every night after our trips, Fairbanks being about equivalent to Trondheim, and Barrow being roughly the latitudinal equivalent of the top of Norway, where we went to a facility at the town of Hammerfest, where they ship LNG out of. You'll notice it has a very variegated coast. It looks not unlike Southeast with all the beautiful fjords they have over there. What we found, okay, a couple of major eye-openers and takeaways. I shot this picture from downtown Oslo, and in the foreground, the White Building, if you don't know, is their $500 million brand-new performing arts center. For those who know me know that I have an interest in this area. That was fascinating. But what really took me was all the cranes, the phenomenal amount of construction that was happening. If I had tipped that camera to the left or tipped the camera to the right, it would have been the same picture. I have never seen so much construction. It was explained to us that this is largely private sector construction. These are anything that has to do with money, your accounting firms, your big banks, they're all there. This is also private, luxury residences going up. It's just an amazing reconstruction of Oslo happening. Prosperity, for sure. We met with the Minister of Petroleum and Energy, and one of the takeaways was this slide. Norway has far more jobs in the oil sector, oil and gas sector, than we do. Our Department of Labor claims 25,000 direct and indirect. We asked what's the equivalent number in Norway, and they said 235,000. I'm not quite sure those are perfectly apples to apples, but that tells you one thing: they have an extraordinarily active oil and gas sector over there. More about that later. And, of course, everybody's favorite slide, this one. Norway's version of the permanent fund. They don't call it a permanent fund, but it's basically that's what it is. And it's bigger than ours. The not so long bar is ours. We're about $40 billion, and at the time this was put together when we were over there, about $570 billion. But all the more remarkable is if you look at the small print there. Take a look at this. Norway's first deposit, 1996, ours, 1997. Since then, they have put 12 billion barrels of production through their pipes. We've put 19 billion since 77. How did they do that? That was a slide we all went over there to solve this mystery. How did that come to pass? And we'll talk a little bit about that. And if I happen not to mention or Brad doesn't hit on it, ask us what it was that how they did that. Now, the bottom line there also they talked to us about, and as they anticipate that before their oil and gas runs out, which they don't know exactly when that's going to be, they figure 50, 75 years or so, their fund will be up to $3 trillion. That's pretty permanent. That's pretty big. A little statistical snapshot of Norway to sort of set the stage. Their population, a little under 5 million, that's about the same population as, say, Minnesota. Half the Norwegians are there, half they're in Minnesota. And maybe a few more here in Alaska, I've noticed. But important to note here is it's a small populated country. It's only seven times the population of Alaska. That's as countries go, that's quite small, seven times the population of here. Tried to get some sense of their relative wealth. And one measurement is income per capita. And here you can see that their income per capita vastly exceeds ours. But as anybody on that tour knew, that wasn't quite a fair comparison. Things over there cost a lot more. We recall the first night we went out for dinner, and we all had to pick up our own bar tab. And my tab for a beer was like $18 for a pint. Now, first, I would say this is the most sober-sided tour group I've ever seen, and that was probably a big part of the reason. It was just simply too expensive to engage in any kind of frills like that. But things over there are expensive, and part of the reason that it's expensive is they have a very high tax regime. 25% of the cost of anything you purchased, roughly, was their value-added tax, similar to a sales tax. So tried to get some kind of comparison that was more apples to apples again. That would take into effect that they have taxes. We don't have as many taxes. Their costs are higher than ours. And so I have it there is the gross domestic product / purchasing power parity of Norway. And I did find a U.S. number, could not find a Alaska number. But compared to the U.S. average, they do quite well compared to the U.S. average. And probably, given that we don't have our tax load's very low here, and that our prices are somewhat lower than theirs, we're probably close to where they are, but probably they're moving ahead is the point. Their economy, their income is rapidly growing. Their unemployment rate, 3%, the lowest in the developed world. They have to import labor. This is a number you're familiar with. The percentage of government annual expenditure paid by oil and gas revenues for them is 10 to 26%. It varies. Sometimes it's even lower than that if they run a surplus, as they have done for the two past years. They just announced a $19 billion surplus in a $100 billion budget. That's significant. On the other hand, we have 80 to 90% here for Alaska to run our government. Just for your information and background, they are a democratically elected unicameral parliament. They don't have an upper and lower house, single house. It's a parliament. They do have a king. He's largely like a lot of the kings in Europe. He's somewhat ceremonial. We took a tour of parliament, and the tour guide there said, everybody in Norway is welcome to come into parliament except for one person, the king. I said, why isn't the king allowed to come in parliament? He has to be invited. And apparently, the rules are over there, the monarch is not allowed to be involved in the making of laws. So he's not allowed to come into parliament, and accordingly, he's very well liked.
Ira, Representative Keller.
I just thought that income comparison, does that include income tax, you know, over there? I
mean, yes. Okay, yeah, they have a very high income taxes, high value added taxes, but even with all that considered, these PPP means how much stuff can they buy? They can buy more stuff than we can buy.
Representative Gardner?
Kind of in the same vein. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the costs that we face is the cost of education. And am I correct in understanding that in Norway, preschool is available at no charge and that university education is free and technical training?
Well, we didn't study that in great detail, but what we did hear, and those of you who heard this too, correct me if you heard differently, Norway pays for some nice things. With those taxes, you get some pretty good things, and one of them is education. They pay for pre-kindergarten all the way through PhD. So if you're going to college and you want to pursue a PhD, they'll cover your education all the way up. Matter of fact, they'll cover your education even if it's not in Norway. If you get accepted at a college in this country, they'll pay for that too.
And if Representative Gardner, if one of your children wanted to go to University of Tromso, it's a free education through a PhD as well, a U.S. citizen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do they have to speak Norwegian?
Nope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make sure they know.
I have alerted my daughters as well. I'm now going to turn this over, next part of the program, over to Brad Keithley, who's going to focus in on the oil and gas systems that we encountered.
Good morning, sir. For the record, your name and affiliation. But before that, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the question of the benefit of education has come up, but I think that everybody should be aware that they also, the retirement system over there is totally unassociated with your job. Retirement is through the state. Everybody gets retirement. So that's not associated with your wages at all. That's a state retirement system, and that's one of the big reasons why their permanent fund is called the retirement fund, because they know they have a lot of liabilities in the future, and that's where those payments come from, as well as universal medical, which is not paid for through your employment or yourself either. That's free. So I'm not meaning to say that we should be there, but people should recognize that when we're talking about those numbers and everything, there are differences in our systems.
Mr. Keithley, for the record, your name and your affiliation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Keithley. I'm a partner and the co-head of the oil and gas practice at Perkins Coie, which is a law firm, an international law firm with offices in Anchorage and elsewhere. I've been an oil and gas lawyer for 35-plus-odd years. Several of those years before joining Perkins Coie was with a firm called Jones Day, where I was also co-head of the oil and gas practice. Jones Day has 2,500 lawyers located globally throughout the world, and as co-head, I had the opportunity to participate and to be involved in a number of projects throughout the world. That's continued with my involvement with Perkins Coie. My purpose in going on the trip was to focus on the oil and gas aspect of the Norwegian system, to try to learn the differences, try to better understand the differences between the Alaskan system and the Norwegian system, and to try to identify areas where Alaska might benefit from the Norwegian system. And I was able to do that, and the purpose of this presentation is going to be to discuss that briefly. As background, Norway's oil and gas industry is rather large. It is the world's sixth largest exporter of oil, the second largest exporter of Europe's gas. Russia is the first. And the Norwegian oil and gas is primarily for export. There are three primary areas of Norwegian oil and gas, one where it's located. One is at the southern end of this map that we have up on the board, which is the North Sea, the historic, traditional first location where oil and gas was discovered. That's shared with the UK, although you can't see the UK. The UK is more in a tropical zone to the south. And the North Sea is the site of the traditional production, although it's also the site of new production as well. The world's second largest discovery last year was in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea. The second area that's being developed currently is the Barents Sea area, which is in the far north. They have oil production. There's also a new LNG plant that's been located in that area, the Snøhvit plant by Statoil, and that is an area that Norway is increasingly focusing on for new oil and gas development. To analogize it to Alaska, the North Sea area is roughly their North Slope. Their traditional historic area, the Barents Sea, is roughly their OCS, Alaska OCS. The third area on the map is the Norwegian Sea, which you can see is a little bit north of the North Sea. That has not been developed. In consultations that the government has had with the communities and the citizens, they have been reticent to develop that area because that's also a very important fishing ground for Norway, and they've had concerns about the ability to the issues arising out of developing that for oil and gas, and so that has not been an area that has been developed as extensively. A summary of what we learned is context. I think the Norwegians, by and large, are not worried about their economic future. If you talk to as we talk to government officials, as we talk to others, I think there's a very secure view of their future. They view oil and gas as being around for a substantial, much longer period of time. And then they view the pension fund or their permanent fund as kicking in at some point and providing them with continued economic certainty. Norway has flattened its oil and gas production decline. I'll talk about that in a bit more in just a moment. And how they've flattened that oil and gas production decline is by attracting investment capital and co-investing in the country's own oil and gas development, not only relying on outside capital to come in and develop the country's resources, but also investing their own capital and helping to drive oil and gas investment in the country. This is a slide that compares the Norwegian production curve with the Alaskan production curve. You can see the Norwegian production curve, as Ira mentioned and as I mentioned just a moment ago, is flattened significantly. There's two pieces to that. The top, the greenish area, is gas. The commercialization of gas, and as I said, Norway is the second largest exporter of gas to Europe, and also developing additional export capability through the development of their LNG facility at Snøhvit. And then the bottom is oil, which has a decline curve, but that the oil decline curve in Norway is certainly not anywhere approaching the severity of the decline curve that we've had in Alaska. My purpose in trying to, if you look at the investment numbers, by the way, the investment numbers similarly are stark between the two regions. Norway has maintained a fairly high level of investment, very high level of investment for oil and gas development, while Alaska, as we know, has undergone a decline in oil and gas investment over the last several years. There's a fairly direct relationship between investment and production. When the investment's in the productive assets, and Norway has benefited in terms of its production from increased investment. The primary lesson we learned is that Norway has successfully attracted private investment to help develop its oil and gas resources. 60-plus international oil and gas producers are investing in Norway. A few of those are represented on this chart, including those that we're familiar with here, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, as well as Chevron, Statoil, Eni, and others. But all in all, Norway has a number more of more investors, heavy investors, in their production than
so
oil and gas.
So, Brad, for, Brad,
yes,
is
sir.
Give one example of how they attract private investment.
The best example, Mr. Chairman, is through co-investing with the private sector. The state participates directly, the same as a producer, in the development of the resource. The state, they don't have, we over here we have a bonus system where a very cash-driven system where producers pay a bonus up front and then pay a royalty to the state on the oil and gas production as it goes along. In Norway, they don't have a bonus system. They don't focus on cash coming from the industry. They focus more on development. And so the industry, the Norwegian policy is when they license a new area, or when, to use our term, when they lease a new area, the state will co-invest through a company called Petoro, will co-invest alongside industry and take a position alongside industry. The effect of that, Mr. Chairman, is to align the interests of the state with the producer in developing the oil and gas resource, and frankly, to give the producer a lot more comfort that the state is going to maintain policies which remain aligned with the independent producers. That, in our observation, I think, has had the most significant impact on developing, on attracting private and maintaining private investment in the country. The term that is used for that investment is, on the slide, is the state's direct financial interest, or SDFI. As I said, the state invests and participates directly, the same as a producer, in the development of the resource. The state substitutes a definitive work and investment commitment on the state's part for getting an upfront lease bonus, and it participates directly in development decisions with the producers in developing the resource. The state becomes an active participant rather than, to some degree, what we have in Alaska as a passive backseat driver. In our opinion, or in our observation, the most significant lesson we learned in Norway was that the SDFI creates an alignment of interests between the state and the producers. The state gains an understanding of the investment dynamics surrounding oil and gas development. The state participates as a working interest owner in the development of fields. The state has, as a working interest owner and as a contributor to the costs of development, it has full access to the data and better understands field dynamics and development than I think we have in Alaska. The state participates as a working interest owner and has the ability to help drive development decisions in the fields, where in Alaska we try to do that through backseat driving. And it increases the state understanding of oil and gas development and reduces state suspicion. Sometimes in Alaska, we think the producers are holding out on information, not telling us the entire picture, and have ulterior motives or other objectives in their development decisions. In Norway, the state is participating in the working interest owner room, is participating in the development decisions, and I think has a much better confidence level in terms of what's driving those development decisions than what we have in Alaska. In short, what you have in Norway is an alignment between the state's interests and the producer's interests in a way, Mr. Chairman, that at least in what we experienced in our discussions there, produces a lot more positive environment for oil and gas development than what we're experiencing over here at the moment. I think probably the most telling evidence that we came across as we went through the discussion, and perhaps the people who are calling in by conference call later in this discussion can address this as well. Norway once used the bonus and royalty system, which we use now, which is get a lease bonus up front and then get a royalty as you go along, and have state participation be through regulation as opposed to direct development. But Norway in the 1980s transitioned away from that, and in fact, not only initially they terminated using lease bonus in new oil and gas leases, but then ultimately they went back and renegotiated all the existing leases to remove the royalty provisions as well, because they concluded it impaired investment decisions. As one of the people that we talked to mentioned, they said, you know, we used that in the early days, and we suggest to other governments when they come to us for advice that they might want to use that in early days when they want cash. Because what the lease royalty system does is produce a lot of cash up front, cost-free cash coming from the producers in terms of the lease bonus and the royalty. But we concluded after a few years it didn't produce development, that it really gave producers the option to hold on to acreage by paying the lease bonus, but it didn't achieve the level of development that we wanted. So we converted over to a system where we helped contribute to that development through state investment and through taking a working interest owner position, and freed them from the obligation of royalty eliminated the obligation of royalty and lease bonus, and we have driven development a lot better since that period of time, a lot more successfully since that period of time. I don't think they meant it pejoratively, but one of the sidebar conversations we had said we used the lease bonus in the royalty system during our juvenile phase when we needed cash. But once we concluded that what we needed was development, we converted over to the co-investment model and have used that since. Mr. Chairman, I see the time's running, and I won't spend a great deal of time on this, but we have given some thought to how we could implement SDFI in Alaska. Norway went through a process of transitioning from the lease bonus and royalty system to similar to what we would face, went through the process of transitioning from lease bonus and royalty to a co-investment model, and we can benefit from thinking about that from what they did, and benefit from thinking about that ourselves. Certainly it can be added as an option in new leases. When we go out and have new lease sales, we could offer SDFI as an option, but that really doesn't reach the low-hanging fruit, because a lot of the oil and gas resources that we can get to immediately and help bring additional production into the pipeline is through the heavy and viscous and other economically challenged oil that's in existing units. So simply adding SDFI as an option in new leases wouldn't really produce the response that I think that we look for in Alaska. So the challenge is to make SDFI available as an option, state direct financial investment, available as an option to help immediately in developing the existing resource. One of the important lessons from the Norwegian model is, in order to do that, to create a professional, non-politicized corporation, similar to the Permanent Fund Board, that would be organized to administer the state's interests in converting to an SDFI. They created a separate state corporation called Petoro, that operates much the way HFC or the Permanent Fund Board does here. That's a critical piece to it, because you can have state participation and it can go really bad. Venezuela is an extreme example of that. Mexico is another example. But the Norwegian model focused on having a non-politicized board. And then create an option for converting to SDFI under existing leases upon mutual agreement. We wouldn't be rewriting our existing contracts, but create the option for producers to switch into an SDF model if they wanted to. Focus on the undeveloped and underdeveloped horizons, the heavy viscous and economically challenged horizons in the existing fields that have not been developed. Potential approach is the state would exchange, as they did in Norway, the state would exchange royalty for a specified ownership percentage, fixes the fiscal terms, and becomes a participating owner in the development of the field. As I said, the lesson I think that we learned from Norway was that this was a way of driving increased investment, of driving increased development, as opposed to simply cash, increased development over time. And the goal, I think, would be is well represented by this chart. This is taken from testimony before House and Senate Resources in 2006, and chose three different alternatives for Alaska's future at that point, picking up 2006 forward. One was zero investment, which would give us roughly a 15% decline rate, reaching the 300,000 barrel point in the 20-teens. The second was $1 billion to $1.5 billion per year of investment by industry, or investment in the development of Alaska's resources, which would result in roughly a 6% decline, reaching that same point roughly in the late 2020s. And the third, and this was even in 2006, this was talked about, was doubling the investment and increasing the development of the state's resources on a near-term basis, bringing about roughly a 3% decline and getting us to the same point by 2050 as opposed to 2030. Frankly, what we've been on for the past several years is the 6% decline curve, the middle decline curve. And if you look at the, even though this is a 2006 projection, if you look at where we are on that decline curve currently, that's a pretty good projection of where we were going to be. I think the Norwegian model, Commissioner Sullivan has talked about it taking $4 to $5 billion per year of investment to get at a decline curve that would look much more like the one on the right, much more like the 3% decline curve, and getting toward the administration's goal of 1 million barrels a day, that sort of investment level, $4 to $5 billion. We're currently running roughly, depends on how you deal with maintenance investment, but we're currently running at $1.6 billion, $1.7 billion, $1.75 billion in investment. And I think in terms of what we saw in Norway, how Norway approached that, the same issue that they were seeing in the 1980s was they decided to step up and invest in themselves alongside industry and achieve alignment with industry. They've pushed their decline curve much more toward the one that's in blue on this chart than we have.
Right. I think what I'll do for the committee is that I've already mentioned that I'd ask Director Barron to be available at the end of the meeting for any questions from committee members. And so, Director Barron, is maybe on the a way forward slide, is maybe between now and then you could think of maybe some baby steps that the legislature and the administration can dialogue on to create an option, you know, baby steps to create an option. And then I'll ask you that question at the end of the meeting. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, for the committee, and I mean, we've done some of this in resources, but Brad, could you kind of talk about the misstep that they made with Statoil, or why they backed away from the Statoil model? Because we haven't differentiated between state investment and the Statoil model versus state direct financial interest, and also their experience on what was the right amount of state direct financial investment that got the right balance between state participation and not interfering with projects.
Sure, Representative Seaton. Norway originally did investment through Statoil, which is now a privately held company that, or a partially privately held company that we're familiar with. Statoil was 100% state owned and was developed in the early 1970s both to hold Norway's interest in the development of oil and gas resources and also to act as an operator and, frankly, help develop the Norwegian service sector. The second largest export from Norway, besides second to oil and gas, is oil and gas services. And what Norway did through Statoil as the operator was help develop, help build up the Norwegian service sector to a point where it's now a world-class service sector. And frankly, there are more offices in Houston of Norwegian companies than there are of any other set of companies. Statoil was, as operator, gained a substantial amount of expertise in oil and gas operations and then started participating in oil and gas operations outside of Norway and, frankly, had its focus diffused between Norwegian projects and outside projects, grew to a point, frankly, where it was becoming bigger than the Norwegian government and had political power that was rivaling that of the Norwegian government. So, in the 1990s, the government changed Statoil in a couple of ways. One, it reduced its share of the interest in the oil and gas resources. It took It allowed Statoil to keep 50% of the interest that the Norwegian government had previously given Statoil, took the other 50% and gave it to Petoro. Petoro is solely focused on Norway, does not have an international flavor. And then also allowed, over the course of a few years, allowed Statoil to increase its international focus and sold a portion of Statoil's shares to the public. In essence, sort of spun off Statoil, if you will, to become a more privatized company and a more international company. Now, it's still 67% owned by the Norwegian government, and so 60% of the dividends still come back to Statoil. Ira has a story, and I think it's correct. Norway will earn more from Alaska's OCS through Statoil's participation than Alaska will. But Statoil has become an international company with international focus. The problem they were facing was there wasn't as much focus on the development of the Norwegian resources as they wanted, so creating Petoro and then having the state's interest held in Petoro's hands, it was part of the refocused efforts in the 1990s and the 2000s. Petoro is a non-operating company. It doesn't try to operate. It's an investment company, basically. It takes, on average, a 20% interest in upstream projects, a 20% working interest in upstream projects. And it's a very efficiently small, very professional organization. There's only 60 people in this company, yet they handle an oil and gas investment portfolio that rivals that of very large independent companies, and indeed rivals that of some majors. So it that's the evolution.
Okay, follow up, and then we'll probably have you wrap up because we have a lot more to go in 45 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess the important thing that Norway told us they found was that when Statoil was getting so large and so independent that their policies might not be what the country of Norway's would have been, that model didn't work. And also that when they did Petoro then, the money doesn't go to Petoro. The money goes to the fund, and the government funds Petoro. So Petoro is not sitting out there as a separately financed and raking in all the money and building up big finances. They operate for the Norwegian government, so the revenue stream is not an independent revenue stream. They're an independent manager, but it's so we want to make sure that we learn all of the lessons from Norway. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please, Brad, if you could wrap up, and then we'll move to our next presentators.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my last slide. So if there are no more questions, I'll turn it back to Ira.
Okay, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is the way that Statoil approaches their investment is on a case-by-case, probably field-by-field situation. It's not a general investment. So did they negotiate those terms with particular companies that want to invest in that as well?
Yeah, Representative Tuck, through the chair. Statoil is now sort of a separate on its own entity. Petoro, what the government does at the time of licensing, what we would say leasing, at the time of licensing, they determine what the government share is going to be, and it may be high if they feel the field has a high probability of success. It may be lower if they feel the field has a low probability of success. But that ownership share will be rolled into the license at the time the license is granted, at the time the license is created. So the private companies know what the ownership share of what the government's, Petoro's financial share is going to be, both in terms of investment responsibility and in terms of revenue takeaway. On average, it's 20%. They do participate in all fields. The government feels that it's important that the government take a position alongside industry. I will say that the government feels it's extremely important that be co-investment alongside industry. The government never wants to be in a position where it's taking a very high percentage or a total percentage of a field, because they feel they learn from industry. They're leveraging up on industry's knowledge and industry's experience and industry's ability to develop oil and gas resources, and they want to remain a co-investor alongside them instead of an operator.
Yeah, one follow-up question.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there any downside that has been revealed in going forward? Are there any obstacles or hurdles that they're trying to overcome to make it better that you can share with us?
Well, the downside that was a big concern at the beginning was lack of success, dry holes. And there were a few dry holes in the beginning. And so the concern is, do you have people who are picking the right percentage and participating in these fields? Do you have experts who know what they're doing, and are they using those investments wisely? And it was a concern that they wouldn't, that they may not do that, and a couple of dry holes probably led to a little bit more concern about that. But by spreading out the investment over all the fields, co-investing alongside industry, it wasn't public funds only that they were putting up. They were putting them up alongside industry. They weren't trying to operate the fields. They spread the risk in a way that's been highly successful. So I think going forward, the concern still is, you know, are we getting the right percentage in these fields? Are we making the right investments? You have to have good managers making these decisions. But that's the primary concern going forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. We'll close with Paul Seaton for Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more thing that we were talking about was the difference between a lease and a license. Over there, the government goes out and does the 2D seismic work and gives that to industry to bid. So it's not a cash bid or a royalty bid, but what is submitted are plans of development. And then the government selects the best plan of development to develop that field. And, you know, it's taking 20% ownership in that as well. So the development phase is much quicker because they've determined the environmental conditions before because they know what the plan of development is. So it's a little more complicated than just saying we're not going to do royalties, we're going to do this other. But it's very doable, I think, for fields in Alaska. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Turn it back to Ira, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
In the interest of time, I won't take up much time. Representative Seaton's comments are correct. What you just heard about the state's direct financial interest is part of a larger licensing system, which includes a number of benefits that overall is a whole system, which includes the initial seismic, which includes getting all the litigious aspects taken care of and out of the way, consistent rules and regulations about environmental protection and safety. They try to get as much known and quantified and predictable in advance so that their investors don't have the wild cards that we have here. And it's a remarkable system. We can provide you with more information with that another time, but okay. that was... So thank you once again for the opportunity. We do agree that the state's direct financial interest is one of many areas, but certainly the biggest area where we could see there's some great potential benefit for the state of Alaska if we went and pursued.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, and of course I'll put for the record is that you'll have an hour at lunchtime.
That's right.
Hosted by the Resources Committee to further expand on your presentation. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, at this time, reminder at 11:15, we're going to go to Norway, and we're going to listen have a presentation by the Norwegian Ministry of Finance Tax Policy Department. But between now and 11:15, I'd ask the co-chair of resources, Paul Seaton, and the powerful subcommittee chairman of transportation for the Finance Committee, Bryce Edgman, to come forward and... and make share your thoughts on the policy tour.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bryce Edgman. I represent the House District 37 in Southwest Alaska. Let me start by saying that I consider myself extremely fortunate to have been part of this experience. It was incredibly invaluable to step outside of Alaska and certainly the political environment that we have surrounding the development of our resources and being able to look through the lens of a country which, while we were over there, you seem to think more often than not really had things figured out. And it was quite fascinating to watch the Norwegians in terms of their unity around their entire strategy about the country going forward. And the fact that their overall goal and
hopefully we'll get into some discussion about it with their petroleum fund and why it's so successful, was to take the profits from their non-renewable resources and put it into a renewable vehicle, i.e. their version of the permanent fund, the petroleum fund, so that it provides benefits to future generations. The similarities between Norway and Alaska were sort of everywhere. You know, Norway obviously is a coastal state with not a lot of folks, with competing interests between fisheries and oil and gas development, a country that very much is positioning itself to be a major player in the opening of the Arctic, and a country as well that has more fully than Alaska has, at least at this point, been able to develop their renewable energy, their hydropower capabilities. And in fact, I think some 92% of all the electricity, and maybe that number is a little bit low, comes from hydropower sources in Norway. And true to form, there hasn't been any major hydro projects built in Norway since about 1992, because those projects have become quite controversial. So we had an opportunity, as you have heard, to have many meetings with different leaders in the government sector as well as the private sector. We traveled to a number of communities from the southern part of the country as well as the northern part of the country. And I wanted to learn more why Norway was successful. And so at the risk of bringing up a controversial issue, I asked, what's in Alaska? We used to have a coastal zone management program. In Norway, how do you bridge those differences, given that you've got one of the world-class fisheries? You've got an area called the Lofoten Islands that's one of the most productive areas in terms of exporting fish products to Europe as a whole and the rest of the world. And we're able to learn about Norway's involvement with a concept been around for a number of years, embraced by a lot of other European countries and countries in the world, called corporate social responsibility, where Norway, over the years, not to get too abstract here, but the country itself has been dominated, it's been occupied by the Germans, by Denmark. It's been in and out of prosperity times. It's lived in the shadow of its giant neighbor, the Russians, and we heard repeatedly how the Norwegians very much prided themselves in having developed sort of a relationship, a detente with the Russians. And in fact, in World War II, the Russians they took kindly upon the Norwegians, and unlike the Germans who came and occupied and thoroughly destroyed a good part of the country in doing so, at least the northern part, the Russians were fairly benevolent to the Norwegians. Where I'm trying to go with all this is a lot of what Norway has done, both in the offshore oil and gas sector with their fisheries and whatnot, has been under the purview of agreements with other countries and built into their permitting process. Of course, is going back to my original point about this corporate social responsibility, is the fact that Norway fully recognizes when you get in the development phase for a project, obviously you're within the realm of capitalism. You're there to make money and you're there to have a profit and do it right. But as well, that the developer has to have a responsibility to the local community and the local culture so that you can bridge that gap and alleviate the differences in terms of controversy that that we see very often here in Alaska. And I'm not trying to make a political statement, but I wanted to convey that to the committee as well, because that was part of our experience that we saw over there. And Mr. Chairman, I see you glancing at the clock. I know time is a factor here, so there's plenty more to offer, and I'll close with those comments.
And your family descended from?
Sweden.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Well, we got just a couple of minutes before we have to call Norway, but maybe we might have to do a two-parter here. But Representative Seaton, your thoughts on the Norway policy tour?
Sure. I thought it was great, and I tell you, when you go to Hammerfest, which is like Barrow, and you find out the ice doesn't come within 200 miles of the shore, you realize that there are some differences. The Gulf Stream has a tremendous impact of the way things are done there. One other thing that we did find as far as lessons that could be applied to Alaska, when we were there talking to the director of oil taxation, we found that the oil companies, all of them, the ones that do business here, all pay their corporate income tax, which is much larger there than it is here, but they pay their corporate income tax on the profits they make in Norway. And we had a situation where in 1978 we realized the same thing, that when you took and apportioned worldwide corporate income taxes, if you were more highly profitable than other places, you ended up lowering your taxes, not to get investment here, but to subsidize less profitable operations around the world. So in 1978, we passed separate accounting. We had it on the books. The oil companies challenged that in court. In 1981, the legislature was here, and there was a $1.8 billion liability, and we didn't have a lot of money in the bank. The legislature was worried. So while it was being appealed to the Supreme Court, it went back to worldwide apportionment, and that was $1.8 billion in just 4 years. That means they would have paid less, and they had paid. And then we won in the Supreme Court, and we won in the U.S. Supreme Court on separate accounting, but we've never gone back to it. And the difference is that if you're an all-Alaska oil company, a Great Bear or Brooks Range or an Ultrastar, you're going to pay the corporate income tax rate on your profits in Alaska. However, the way we do it with worldwide apportionment, it means that if you're an international oil company, you can pay much less than an Alaska-based company. So I think that one of the things we've learned is that the oil companies are knowledgeable about separate accounting. They, you know, it's a procedure that's gone all the way through the courts here, and it's something that we need to consider to equalize the effects on Alaska companies versus just international companies, so that everybody pays the same rate. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we'll look at that in further detail.
Okay, well, we're calling Norway as we speak, but a question is that separate accounting, of course, will be maybe vetted in other committees during this legislature. I just wanted to share with the committee that that is not the intent of the resolution, is to essentially create a bill that would speak about direct investment options. It would not be a doc about separate accounting. This is the resolution is about asking the legislature for committees to start thinking and talking about those. So is it your intent that in another committee that separate accounting may be brought forward?
Mr. Chairman, I think that if we're looking at the lessons we learned in Norway, SDFI is one very important piece, but another thing that Norway has learned that they apply that we don't is everybody, whether you're you're locally based company or whether you're an international, you pay the same tax rate. And that is something that I think that as the discussion goes along, if we're talking about other tax changes and all, then I would presume that we would want to make sure that we're not disadvantaging oil companies from forming and being Alaskan oil companies, and more advantaging international oil companies than we are Alaskan oil companies. So I think that that'll be part of the conversations that'll go forward. Yes, and I just wanted to say that, you know, we're talking about what we saw in Norway and what worked for Norway, and I'm not saying that everything that works for Norway would work for us, but that was one thing that we've already been through and been through courts and found that it was something that did work for us as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We do have Norway on the line. It is 11:15 Alaska time. It is 9:15 p.m. Norway time, and we appreciate our friends in Norway for staying up late to have to give a presentation to Alaskans. Is Lone Simmingsen and Beate Benson online?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Well,
hello.
Yes. Well, good evening to you, and it's good. It's of course morning here back in Alaska. If you could, for the record, state your name and your affiliations, and I understand you have a 10-minute presentation.
My name is Lone Semmingsen. I work in the tax policy department here in the Ministry of Finance in Norway, Oslo. I am a deputy director general here. And I am Beate Benson. I am a director legal, and I work in the tax law department here in the Ministry of Finance in Norway.
Please,
can you hear us?
Yes, loud and clear. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure if I should say good morning or good afternoon or good night even. But thank you very much for inviting us to attend your hearing in Alaska. As you heard, we work for two different departments here in the Ministry of Finance, and we share the responsibility of resource rent taxation in Norway. I would like to start by saying a few words on why we tax natural resources different from other. When exploiting or utilizing a limited natural resource, there is a potential for an extraordinary rent, known as the resource rent. In addition, the natural resources are generally immobile, so this means that the production cannot move, even though we put it under quite heavy tax weight. Further, the resources belong to the public, the people of Norway. And from the government's point of view, this makes resource industries good and legitimate tax bases. While ensuring a reasonable public share to the profits from the petroleum sector, it is important to attract profitable investments by reliable investors. We have, in our experience, there are some main considerations to be made. Make sure that this is achieved. First of all, a stable tax system and policy framework is of great importance. We have seen that frequent and unforeseen changes in the tax rules may scare away investors. Therefore, stability and predictability have been key considerations in Norway. Today we take around 80 to 85% of the value of the petroleum production. At the same time, we have put emphasis on simple tax rules that apply to all investors, including the partially owned oil company Statoil. The equal tax treatment of all petroleum companies has been essential to maximize the output from the sector and to reduce the administrative burden. There is no room for a bilateral agreement between the company and the government. A simple tax system also reduces the possibilities for the companies to avoid the taxes. Further, there is no tax system is better than the way it is enforced. So we have a highly competent tax administration, even though it's relatively small. I think it is about 40 to 50 people. We also put weight on ensuring taxpayers' rights. There is the companies can have the right to meet the norm price board. They can complain on the decisions made by the Oil Taxation Office, and they can even bring their cases to court. In Norway, we use a variety of government take instruments in the petroleum sector. We have the direct taxation of petroleum companies, which I will talk a bit more on later. And we also have some indirect taxes. There is a CO2 tax that should give the companies incentives to reduce CO2 emissions. And we have an area fee that is supposed to give the companies incentives to free fallow acreage. The central government also holds direct financial interests in many oil and gas fields. This is an arrangement where the government, in the same way as other licensees, pays a share of all investments and operating costs and receive a corresponding share of oil and gas production. The state direct share is decided on separately for each field, and it varies between fields. Finally, we have ownership. The government owns 67% of Statoil and receives the corresponding share of Statoil's dividend. We have no upfront payments or no fee on production. We previously had a royalty. It was phased out from 2000 and abolished in 2006. Historically, royalty has been an important income to the Norwegian government relative to taxes, and SDFI was negative because it was making investments in the early years. Today, taxes and SDFI are the most important government take instruments. Let me say something more about the petroleum tax system. As all other sectors in Norway, the petroleum sector are subject to ordinary tax on profits. It is a uniform net profit tax with a rate of 28%, and it's levied on a broad tax base. In addition to this, there is a special tax. Production on the Norwegian continental shelf started in 1971, and as early as 1975, we had a resource rent tax in place. The system has been relatively stable, and since 1992, we have had the same marginal tax rate. The special tax is levied as a net surplus taxation on a company basis. This means that it's not ring-fenced around each field. The companies are allowed to consolidate costs and income from all fields in their portfolio. However, we have a ring-fencing against mainland activities. The additional tax rate is 50%, and it's only levied on the extraordinary profit. This is taken care of giving an extra deduction to shield the ordinary returns from the special tax. This is known as the uplift. Some later amendments to the system have been made that gives the companies full security for deductions in the special tax. From 2002, uplifts and losses can be carried forward with interest. Further, if a company terminates its engagement on the Norwegian continental shelf, losses are transferable, or the tax value will be paid by the government. Let me also say that we have a very similar system for the hydropower production, which is based on, although it's based on the natural resource, limited natural resource. We like to underline that we have a profit-based taxation system. It is only if there is a net surplus in the company that will that the company will pay taxes. This promotes investments, and it also implies a symmetric sharing of risk and return between the government and the investor. On the other hand, gross-based tax instruments as a fixed fee requires the investor to pay taxes even if there are no profits. A few more words on the state direct financial interest. This is the other large income source from the petroleum activities to the government of Norway. This is an arrangement whereby the government keeps an interest in a number of oil and gas fields, pipelines, and onshore facilities. The SDFI was established in 1985 when Statoil was split into two. one direct financial share for the state or government and one which remained with Statoil. However, from 1985 to 2001, Statoil continued to manage the entire portfolio. That is, they managed the SDFI portfolio on behalf of the government. When Statoil was listed and partially privatized in 2001, the administration of the SDFI portfolio was transferred to a new state-owned trust company called Petoro. Petoro is funded over the state budget, and it does not receive any of the income from the SDFI. It's also very important to emphasize that Petoro is not an oil company. In the SDFI, each interest is decided when the license for a field is awarded, and the size of the government interest varies. As one of several licensees, the government pays its share of investments and costs and receives a corresponding share of the gross income from the license. Currently, the SDFI takes a share only in the most promising licenses. Therefore, the SDFI is an important instrument for increasing the government's overall take in licenses with high expected profitability. You could say that the SDFI works similarly to a cash flow tax of 100% on the share of the government share of the license. However, it is somewhat more than a tax because it also involves ownership to real capital installations on the shelf. Our overall experience is that the take composition in Norway has fulfilled its primary task over time. It has secured government income from the petroleum activities and at the same time allowing for the resources to be exploited in an economically efficient way. So this is what we have prepared. I don't know if there's any questions you want to ask. We'll be happy to answer.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you for your presentation. Before we go to questions, I just want to share a couple of comments with you, of course, but also with committee members and the people in the audience, is when we traveled to your office, of course, we had to go through the area of where the explosive device went off right before we got to Norway, and met with you in your office. So there's about 30 Alaskans there, legislators, of course, Institute of the North, and many others, including Larry Pershley. And I think that collectively we were struck by about your professionalism and your ease at I guess, answering all the questions. It seemed like at sometimes some of my colleagues and other visitors to your country were trying to trip you up, and they were unsuccessful in doing that. You were very articulate, and made a huge impression on all the Alaskans that visited your office. So I just wanted to say that, and I thank you very much for your hospitality. So with
you.
With that, I would go to the floor, and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. we are, you know, we're looking at or investigating what SDFI could look like and work for us. And I guess one of the questions is, you know, we don't have too much problem on new fields, but on old fields, if we would take a if we would renegotiate and take a share, let's say a 20% share, have you had any experience with then going back and negotiating something like that and then ending up with a large liability for the need mobilization and the remediation of the facilities if it's an old existing field that would have a shorter time horizon?
As I said, the SBFI is decided on the time of when the license is awarded. I think that earlier on we had a sliding scale, which meant that this was stated in the license that if the resources were larger than what was expected or more profitable than what was expected, the SBFI could increase its share. In our experience, this was not very well taken by the oil companies that the government wanted to increase their share. So this has been abolished in the Norwegian system.
Okay, Representative, one follow-up question.
Yeah, and so I think what I understood from your last comment was you go in at the very first of the investment. You're not coming in partway after when there's development. You're not changing your share. You're deciding on what the share will be for SDFI, so everybody knows up front, and that won't change through the through the production. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. We have another question. Representative Chris Tuck from Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you guys are putting your request for proposals for your fields there in the beginning when you do your licensings, do you have a lot of competition? Is there a lot of companies? You know what average number of companies that are trying to partner with you in developing those fields?
This is the Ministry of Finance field of experience responsibility. No, it is the Ministry of Energy and Petroleum. But there is an open bidding, but they don't pay for getting a license. But it's kind of an auction where they say what their work program will be, how many holes they will drill and what they will do to develop the field. So this is then collected by the Ministry of Energy and Petroleum, and they decide on which companies have the best work program and put together the license group.
Mr. Chair. Representative Tuck is in an earlier side, literally dozens of companies wish to invest in Alaska. But a follow-up question for our presenter?
And that was it. I was trying to find out how many are proposals they receive on a field that they're trying to...
We'll ask the other ministry for that information. I'll have staff get that to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, see no other questions. Ms. Simington, I appreciate your spending your evening with us in Alaska. And again, I very much appreciate your hospitality and your professionalism and the job you do for your country.
Thank you. And thank you for having us. It was quite an experience for us to participate in this.
Okay. And good evening to you.
Thank you. Bye.
We had originally scheduled Chancellor Myers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks to join us, but we're running out of time, so I've asked him to return to visit with us next Thursday when the committee will discuss the concurrent resolution. So we have a couple more minutes, and as promised, I'd like to ask Bill Barron, Director of Division of Oil and Gas, to come forward. And Bill, I'll preface this that we're not here to trip you up, and so let me restate my question. Is that in one of the slides that Mr. Keithley had presented is maybe the resolution, or the resolution is asking the legislature to explore these lessons that we learned in Norway. And so his slide is to create an option for curting to SDFI. So I'm not asking you to, get in any depth, but again, the question is, do you have, is there some baby steps, some criteria about starting that dialogue to create an option that the administration would want to ask the legislature to consider, because this has got to be a dialogue with the administration as well. So that's really all I'm asking. Just what are some baby steps that we should consider?
For the record,
I'm Bill Barron, and I am the director of oil and gas for the state of Alaska. And Chairman, thank you for clarifying that that request that you threw out to the audience while I was in there. The Norwegian model is a very interesting model to look at, and it is not really unique to the industry or to international endeavors. Many, many countries have the opportunity to step into, either initially or even as a back end, to a working interest share in their development of their natural resources. So the Norwegian model is not something that I'm not personally unfamiliar with. I have worked some Norwegian fields, and I've also worked some other international projects that have something similar. To your question, I think what really needs to happen is exactly what you've proposed, is dialogue and more investigation on questions. The trying to convert from a tax and royalty system to a system that you are actually taking your working interest in a property is quite a conundrum. How do you go from being the regulator to being regulating the regulator? How do you compensate or analyze what the plan is? Is it a plan for exploration, or is it a plan for development? Those are two distinctly different plans and programs that need to be vetted. The Norwegian model, actually, they pay for upfront 2D seismic. That's good in an area, for example, like the North Slope foothills. That would be an investment by the state, just in dollars, of roughly $1.6 to $1.8 billion. That would take 4 to 5 years to shoot, and it would take another 3 to 4 years just for the initial primary analysis of the data. That is just to get the data to the companies. Where I'm trying to get to this, and Representative Seaton's question about DRNR, when you step in as a working interest owner, you step in fullness. You step into the good and the bad. If product price goes below your operating cost, you lose money. If you're part of the vote and you're at 20% and the 80% owners decide they don't want to do a project, the project does not go forward regardless of what your vote is. DRNR, abandonment liabilities, you are fully part of that 20%. And is the state prepared to step into those shoes? Is the state prepared to step into their share of a significant environmental disaster? As a working interest owner, you are. Tax regimes, fiscal regimes. Just because you're a working interest owner does not mean that you have any more leverage in negotiating with the legislature on changing, enhancing, or modifying fiscal regimes. That's the legislator's responsibility. So as a working interest owner in the field, you are now the recipient of those taxation laws. Part of what I'm trying to get to, Chairman, is it's just a cascade of questions, and all of these are very few of these are technical questions. Most of these are policy questions. Most of these are directional questions. Most of these are philosophical questions that then, once resolved, become technical questions and administrative questions. It's the dialogue that needs to take place. Is the state prepared to do these things? And if you're not able to get into some of the existing fields, is that really going to be an advantage for the state in the near term in terms of exploration of new areas and then subsequent development? I'm thinking that there is actually going to be a time delay in exploration effort as current with in exchange for our current program. But, you know, that's just as I'm looking at a kind of a long-term calendar. Norwegian model is good for Norway, but we also have to think about, in every concession that I worked internationally, it is not a buffet. You just don't take one piece of their fiscal system and discard another. These are very complicated negotiated concession terms that cover all sorts of socioeconomic parameters. And a give in one side has got to be a take somewhere else. So it is a very dynamic geopolitical discussion to have.
Thank you, Mr. Behrens. Appreciate that. We just got a couple more minutes before we're going to gavel out, so thank you, sir. Is that I'll extend the courtesy for Ira and Nils to come back up. If you haven't noticed, there's a lot of wanted posters around the building with your two faces on there. So why don't you just share with the committee and the camera what's going to happen during the lunch and learn today? Please, for the record.
Again, my name is Ira Perman. I'm the chair of the board of the Institute of the North. Lunch and learn today, we'll have much of what you've heard from us today will be presented to a larger group of your peers. We will be able to go into some additional depth because we have some additional time. We have the whole hour as opposed to the shorter time here. So we'll have the opportunity to talk a bit more about the licensing system, as Representative Seaton had alluded to, talk a bit more about Statoil and its history and how it's developed. And we'll also have, once again, time for questions as well. And we also have a very nice lunch, so please come and join us for that.
All right. Thank you very much, and we look forward to that. So the intent of the chair for next Thursday is if you have suggestions for edits or deletes or additions to the resolution, I'd like to debate it, and then we'll take testimony from Chancellor Myers, and we'll decide at that time if the resolution is ready to leave the committee. So if there's no comments, 11:45, we're adjourned.